Yeah, okay, so the question has to do with how is it that, using the example of Buddhists in Southeast Asia who have, there have been some recent events where they have entered the streets, so to speak, in protest of social injustice, and how is it that a movement and a practice that so much emphasizes accepting things as they are also inspires that kind of engaged action. And interestingly, we see some of these things in the news once in a while, but my experience of Buddhism is that it is at all levels engaged, that it is an extraordinarily transformative process, and that it is inconceivable to think of transforming ourselves without transforming our community. It makes no sense. So when I lived in Thailand in the monasteries, I traveled to quite a number of monasteries, and many, if not all of them, were actually all very responsive to the community in which they lived. One was in an area where there were many very poor villagers who were not honestly very good with money, and they would, there's a lot of drunkenness in the area. They would spend their paycheck, so they would have this arrangement with the monks, and even though the monks didn't handle money, they would guard their funds. So they would get their paycheck, basically, you know, I don't remember what day it was, but say Friday, they would get their paycheck. And they would go right to the monastery, and they would give most of it to the monastery to hold for them, so that they would have something on Monday. And then they would come back, and they would come back and get it. And so the monks understood that this particular community really couldn't handle some of these very social needs. And so they would offer their services, because some of the monks were educated and had no interest in their money personally, so they were trustworthy. And these people weren't savvy, you know, they didn't have like banks in these areas or any of these institutions. So the monks just helped out in certain ways by providing a container for that. There was another place I lived where there was a problem with drought for a good part of the year, and it was a cause of great difficulty. And so the monks put off a portion of their land to build a reservoir, and organized the villagers to develop that reservoir and to build smaller reservoirs and wells in different parts of the surrounding areas, so that they could survive through the drought period each year, and they could collect the rainwater when they had it. And so these were projects that were literally initiated by the monks of benefit for the villagers who were living in a more agricultural and kind of a buffalo rearing kind of community. And there were lots of times when I would go and ask one particular monastery I was staying in, I wanted to go see the abbot, and they'd say, oh no, he's at the police station today, because somebody got arrested, and the family didn't know what to do, so they went to the monastery, and the abbot would go down to the police station and just help negotiate the bail or the release or the lawyers or basically whatever was needed. And so these are very small village kind of examples, but they're very inspiring to me in the sense that there was never in my experience of Buddhism in Asia a sense that practice was separate from community. They were always intertwined, and the needs of the community were intertwined and integrated with or interdependent with the needs of the monastics, and each would support each other in whatever means they had. And often the monastics were more educated in some of these places, because I was practicing in places that were largely not just sometimes rural Thai places and sometimes tribal areas. And the monastics were often more educated than the population in the area, so they provided a service as well as schools and other kinds of services. And that's all in addition to the primary service, which is of spiritual inspiration and providing a practice that isn't just going to address how do we handle money and can we get through the weekend. When you look at the discourses of the Buddha, you see that he taught differently for different people. And when lay people asked him questions about money, he answered not just free yourselves from money and ordain. No, he said that there are different ways that are skillful to use money. And it's important how we earn it. And it's important how we spend it. And it's important how we save it. And it's important how we give it. And that for in terms of, he gave clear teachings about money that included saving, giving, earning, and spending. So he didn't just say, oh yeah, go renounce everything and shave your head and don't deal with money. So sometimes the concept that we have about meditation and Buddhism is a little bit more strict than the actual experience of it, which is much more integrated. Now, you mentioned in particular the teaching on accepting things as they are. And what happens when we accept things as they are? What happens when we open to the very fact of just sitting here right now? You know, there's some sound, maybe there's some ache in the body, maybe there's some experience of mind. And inevitably we will come to realize that mental and physical processes that we are accepting as they are now are suffering. They are not going to be the place to get lasting satisfaction. When we recognize that suffering within ourselves, it naturally brings forth a compassion. I see this in all the groups. People listen, and as you're listening to the groups, I don't sense that you're sitting there going, oh, judging, what a crazy question. I instead am seeing again and again, yeah, I understand that. Yeah, I can respond to that. A sense of, I feel a connection and a compassion because I too understand that suffering. And as we open to what really is moment by moment, the compassion deepens. And then we're able to respond even more to the suffering that surrounds us in the world. And if we're faced then with a political climate that is enforcing oppression, then we might respond to that. If we're faced with an economic problem, we might respond to that. If we're faced with an interpersonal or social problem, we might respond to that. But we'd be responding out of the compassion that understands things as they actually are. So we're not going to be responding by applying an ideal to the situation. Oh, I think all beings should be like this, and then we force people to be like that. No, the response that comes out of accepting things as they are is knowing the truth of suffering and knowing that there is a cause of suffering and that that cause of suffering can be transformed. And the ending of suffering occurs with the ending of the cause of suffering. And we're motivated to end the cause of suffering. That's what we're doing here. We're not just hanging out. I mean, we're looking into the mind because we all want to be free from suffering. And so we want to understand the causes of suffering so that we can extract those. And as we see them within ourselves, we naturally start to see them in our communities and in our societies and in our governments. And we do what we can, whenever we can, to alleviate oppression and suffering, and mostly to extract the causes. Because this asks us to look at the causes, it asks us to look beyond political parties. It asks us to look beyond superficial political views.
and to look at the root causes of greed, hate, and delusion that perpetuate suffering. And so hopefully, as our understanding deepens within our meditation practice, our analysis of social problems will also become more and more wise, and hopefully our actions will become more and more skillful and have even a greater potential to transform society. I've been very inspired by the Buddha's social teachings. He was quite radical, actually. Even just if you look at his teachings on class and caste are quite transformative. I mean, his inclusion of women in the monastic order, there's many things that went against prevalent views of social hierarchies at the time, and he was willing to speak out to the potential of the human mind to be free and to help people in all areas of life and from all facets and all stratas of society to realize that freedom. And in the process of that realization, society is affected. Did that respond to your question? Any other questions today? Are you free of doubt? Free of perplexity? Free of confusion?
I don't know where I work stuff.
She mentioned the attachment for getting praise. So if you can elaborate.
Well, the question,
other people.
The question has to do with Sandhya's talk last night when she talked about the subtler forms of craving or attachment, in particular the attachment to receiving praise, being seen, being acknowledged, being belonging. And I see a lot of that desire to circle around as to be a manifestation of a basic form of attachment, which is the attachment to a concept of self. Because when we are attached to a notion of being someone who is like this or like that or is seen this way or seen that way, then we keep having to construct and to put forward this image of ourselves. If we have the image of being a capable and responsible person, then we need to be seen doing capable and responsible things. And we might actually steer away from or not want anybody to see us when we are incapable, like when we're sick or when we're injured, or when we're not responsible, like not really want to tell people about some like wasteful holiday sort of thing that we did, you know, or something that we're not so proud of. But we want to put forward all of this, I work so hard and I do this and this. You know, that's just an example of when we have a certain image, then we often want to put that forward so that people then confirm that image back through us by seeing us as we want to be seen. Now, we do a lot of these social games by presenting our personas and our images and getting this recognition. And we like the recognition when it conforms to who we want to be, how we want to be seen. And we don't like the recognition when it's not who we want to be seen. You know, then we call that criticism or judgment or something else, you know, something that we don't like. But they're basically continuing this basic attachment to this concept of self. And that is something we must question in our practice. what is this attachment to being someone? Whether we're this or that, there's this movement of wanting to be special or wanting to be seen or just wanting to be. And it's that fixedness or that static perception of a self that is out of alignment with the truth that this mind and this body and every single experience is continuously changing. What are we? We're really just a moment of clinging that occurs in relationship to momentary events. Mind and body come together in an experience. We cling it and say, me, look at me, quick, before it disappears. And then there's another me. Ooh, quick, look at this one. And one of the things that happens just when we spend time in silence, and you might experience this in retreats, you might experience it just hiking. You know, have you ever just gone for a trek? When I was in India, I did a 28-day trek in Ladakh. And this, you can talk about this and that for the first few days with your trekking companions, but how long before just everything that you talk about just seems so far removed and inconsequential, and the only thing that feels real is just the lifting of the foot and the placing it down. I mean, we passed one road in 28 days, and we just crossed it, and it was over, just like that. So you can experience the quietness that lets a lot of the social constructions of self fall away, and then find that there really is just this momentary experience that arises and passes of mind and body. And if we go through life experiencing this, just the flow of changing events, we'll find a real harmony and peacefulness and vivid clarity in it. But each time we find that the mind contracts around that particular moment and tries to make it last, make it seen, put it on a billboard, you know, put it in a frame, that one's me, this other one's not, but that one's me, then it's like we've taken something out of harmony, and we feel that stuckness, we feel that contraction. And it can be interesting in meditation to just watch the arising of this self, and what we're observing is this contraction and this release and this contraction and this release. And in the release, we're vividly aware of what's really happening. And in this contraction, we're often holding on to some concept that we're interpreting things through. And then when that releases, we're really more aware, very aware, of just this flow of changing experience. So you might just notice sometimes this contraction and release, contraction and release. And as you notice it in your meditation, then when you enter into interactions, I want to be seen. Sometimes we'll be meditating and we'll want to be seen. You know, our eyes are closed. We know that everybody else in the room has their eyes closed too. But still there's this little thought that says, oh, I hope somebody sees me. I'm sitting so well. So upright. Do they know that I'm virtually enlightened? So sometimes we don't actually have to be in interaction for that to really crop up. And then right in that moment, feel that. Recognize that desire to become. That craving for becoming. That craving for being. That craving for recognition and that selfing process. Now, we'll be breaking silence tomorrow. And when we break silence, it's an opportunity to see that selfing form in relationship. Because you'll see that when you interact with people, that selfing will probably arise in one form or another. Just observe it. It's very interesting to watch. I mean, it's quite humorous to see how much of our interactions are me and me and me and me and you and you and me and you and me and you. And it's very interesting. And it can be lovely to once in a while drop both the me and the you and just connect with a kind of love or connection or truth or wisdom that just sees things as they are right in that moment. And there can be a kind of intimacy that is not separated. Punjaji said, love. I forgot the opening of the quote that I like what it said, but basically he says that love that is divided is not love. So when we see an I and a you and then try to connect across this division of I and you and call that love, we're actually putting up barriers first. And once in a while you'll be able to just drop all those formations of self and just connect and realize that there can be a love that is undivided. And you'll experience a depth of intimacy, a depth of connection that doesn't presuppose the I and hope that the you perceives the I the way you want to be seen. Thank you.
About the 2 days or even myself. So while I was speaking, I felt a lot of guilt, saying that I'm built all of cravings, I'm built all of cravings. And after that, after the talk, I felt somehow very distant from all of this. It seemed very cold, very monistic, or when you look at your everyday life, most of us are not monks. We don't live a monastic life. And we do enjoy the peace, and we do have relationships, and we do need sometimes the warmth of others or other things. So yes, there is a kind of craving. I know that in everyday life, when you're not a monk, somewhere lies the in-between. You don't have to be a monk to practice. Teachings. So I'm trying to find this.
So our question has to do with the craving and recognizing that she's not a monastic and lives with, you know, desire for pleasant tastes and relationships and various other cravings in life. I guess I would have to ask a question back first. And do you experience any suffering in craving?
Of course I do.
Okay.
On one side, I don't want to feel guilty, and I do want to practice
this
teaching, but on the other side, I don't want feel so distant, like it's a guilt.
You know, sometimes we hear the teaching, a craving is the cause of suffering, and we want to seek the ending of craving. And so we have an image of being some kind of a cold, desireless blob that has no feeling and lives life as a kind of monotone, and nothing is very interesting. But I prefer to approach this practice by each and every time that we see the movement of craving in our lives, to ask ourselves, is this leading to happiness or suffering? And if it's leading to happiness, we cultivate the aspects that further happiness. So there might be some ways in which intimacy and connection and honesty and a wise relationship is actually a good association in our life. And there might be aspects of craving where we can sense this part is really leading to suffering and free ourselves from that. so that we just do it in our lives, in the present moment, with the craving that we perceive. I don't think there's any point in adopting a lifestyle. Like, I don't suggest that you even become a Buddhist, let alone ordain. You know, don't become something that seems to be a lifestyle that would be like an idealized image. Okay, now if I become this, then I will be free from craving, or if you know, or then I will be working in the ideal way or something. I don't approach it that way at all. I think right in this moment we see where is the craving and how can we be free of whatever craving is leading to suffering. I love that Ananda encouraged that nun I mentioned the other night to cultivate craving, that craving can be developed to support the end of craving. It's like it's one of the final releases, because we abandon the grosser to realize the subtler. We abandon the aspects that seem like they're very clearly going to lead to suffering to cultivate what's more refined. So for instance, one thing that you might recognize is that it's one thing to have a certain kind of craving or delight that delights in and that appreciates a pleasant experience. There's another kind of craving that demands it and rests our happiness upon it, and we will be miserable if we don't get it. It's very different to express a desire or to express a demand. And we can recognize that if we're expressing the demand, well, we can't control the situation. And so, of course, it's going to lead to suffering. Now, we can appreciate a situation, but if there is craving for it that's attached to it, eventually it will change, and it also will go. So if there was attachment, we would suffer. So I think we work incrementally, and we work with the craving that's actually present. Well, it's time for lunch. I would like to announce that the schedule is different this afternoon. So please do look at the schedule. And whoever's the bell ringer this afternoon, please definitely look at the schedule, because we're returning to the hall for the next sitting meditation at 2:30. That's 15 minutes earlier than we have been returning. So please adjust your after lunch activity appropriately.